First item on the agenda is my report, which I will present to you. I have several points to report upon. We had a discussion with regard to our relationship with IOSCO, the Organization of Securities Commissions. We've had already for quite a long time very good relations with IOSCO that, by the way, was very instrumental in the launching of the new IFRS Foundation in the early 2000s. As a consequence of the strategy review that insists on the need to work on implementation, enforcement, and feedback in a better way, we believe that improving the working relationship with the securities regulators through IOSCO is of the essence, and therefore we are working on a kind of working arrangement with IOSCO, and more specifically with their committee policy number one that deals with financial information, governance, audit, accounting, and the like. So we're making good progress in this direction. The second item we discussed once again, and which is a complex one, is the funding of the IFRS Foundation. We have analyzed the present situation. We know that we have to stabilize the system for the long term. The trustees, when they adopted their strategy review, insisted on the fact that the funding of the IFRS Foundation, I quote, should not be contingent on fulfilling any conditions that would compromise the independence of the standard setting process, end of quotation. And this means that we have to find the right balance between the publicly sponsored funding and other sources. We do appreciate the contributions we receive today from jurisdictions around the world, but we know that we still have to work to stabilize this, to enlarge, and in some cases to sort out some difficulties. We also try to think about new approach to the licensing or of intellectual property of the IFRS Foundation. This is not an easy question for an organization such as ours, which deals with public interest and obviously is a non-for-profit organization and doesn't have a commercial approach to these issues. We confirmed some orientations that we had talked about at the last meeting. Relying on the criteria with regard to GDP to determine the contribution of countries, harmonizing the system, and as we would move to this GDP approach, removing some details that existed in the past, and, one of them being a financing discount for emerging and developing economies. If we rely on the GDP, this their position is taken into account. We have discussions with our U.S. colleagues, with discussions with the EU and a number of other contributors. The third item we talked about was the development of the strategy review itself. This strategy review was issued early last year, together with the Monitoring Board Governance Review, and there were a series of recommendations there, for implementation by the IFRS Foundation. And the trustees have considered the recent developments and noted that most of the actions resulting from the governance and strategy reviews have indeed been implemented in full and without modification. So we will issue a report on this and send it to the monitoring board as a follow-up to the strategy review report itself. The only item that remains under consideration is precisely the long-term financing of the organization. We then had a discussion on a most interesting paper on the Canadian use of IFRS, and the survey has been carried out independently by the Canadian FEI and supported by the Canadian authorities and the IFRS Foundation. And this survey addressed the issue of the cost of implementation for new adopters. And we think that this study is extremely interesting and helpful to provide information to new adopters, and we look forward to the publication of this survey next week. We then considered the development of IFRS around the world. We had a discussion on the recent developments in Europe, where we see institutional reforms being considered by the European institutions. The EU Commissioner in charge of these issues, Michel Barnier, has asked Philippe Mechtat, who's the former Vice Minister and Minister of Finance of Belgium and the former Chair of the European Bank of Investment, to report on the present arrangements within the EU and on the governance of the European bodies. We've been discussing this with Mr. Mechtat on two occasions, and we are following this process, which is obviously an internal issue for Europe, but which nevertheless has consequences on the way we cooperate with Europe, which is clearly excellent today, but we have to see how it will develop in the future. We also talked about developments in the EU. There have been a number of changes there at the top level. We had an initial meeting with the new chair of the SEC, Mary Jo White, and we've had some encouraging statements there, so this is also a strategic issue under consideration. And we then had a presentation of recent developments in Japan that are extremely encouraging. We see a process whereby a number of major Japanese companies are adopting IFRS, and there are considerations within Japan today to facilitate the adoption of IFRS. And we foresee a situation where the companies that would be IFRS registrants would represent at least 20% of the total market cap of the Tokyo of the Japanese stock exchange, which is obviously extremely encouraging. We noted the intention by the Japanese authorities to introduce a new index of international companies listed in Japan, whereby a requirement for inclusion within the index would be the use of IFRS. And we noted that as a transition, the Japanese authorities would consider some additional version of Japanese GAAP that would be closer to full IFRS, but that would clearly be Japanese. And we, on the whole, welcomed the positive evolution in Japan. We then had a discussion on the developments with regard to emerging markets. Since the beginning of 2013, we have allocated a greater amount of time to discuss this issue, and the trustees discussed the support offered by the IFRS Foundation and the ISB to meeting the needs to of emerging economies. In November 2010, the G20 leaders called upon the ISB to further develop its outreach to emerging economies. During our meeting, we reviewed numerous steps taken by the ISB consistent with this recommendation, and we expressed our satisfaction that this objective has been met. Specifically, the ISB's creation of an emerging economies group, as well as representation of emerging economies across the IFRS Foundation, and the ISB's decision-making and advisory function and its working group is also a demonstration of the attention we provide to these issues. Of particular relevance to emerging and developing economies is the IFRS for SME standard that is now adopted by more than 80 countries, and we discussed feedback received from the ISB's comprehensive review of the IFRS for SMEs and how to respond to that feedback. Discussion is whether the IFRS for SMEs should be considered as an integral part of the single set of standards, whether and to what extent the ISB should express view on what sort of companies should apply the IFRS for SMEs within a jurisdiction. And the trustees' feedback from this discuss will be used to further develop the thinking of the ISB. Finally, we had a few important decisions with regard to nominations. I would like to mention the reappointment of Pedro Mellon, Dick Van Sluimers, and Antonio Soido. We welcome the presence of Dr. Abdulhaman Al-Humaid from Saudi Arabia. He was present with us for some time, but it was his first attendance to the board. And also we welcome the appointment of Choji Okada from Japan, who was present with us today. We have a series of nomination under consideration, which is the process we deal with. So I'll stop here. I would only mentioned, but I will do it again at the end of this meeting, the very successful stakeholder event that took place yesterday, and the very warm hospitality we have received from SAICA here in Johannesburg. This has been really a fruitful and very friendly meeting, and I would ask Wise Man Kulu to be my interpreter to again thank our South African colleagues for their warm welcome. I stop there. If you have any questions? If not, I will hand over to Hans de Voorst for the chairman of the ISB's report.
Thank you, Michel. I am happy to report that I think the last 3 months have been very productive for the ISB. We got a lot done and a lot of important things done. The last time I talked to you, I mentioned that we had published an exposure draft on leases. And in the last months, we have started our outreach activities. And we started with users, with investors and analysts. I'm happy to say that there seems to be very broad support for bringing leases to the balance sheet, which is the prime purpose of our standard. Currently, most investors do their own adjustments. They do see leases as financing, and they adjust the balance sheet for them. But they all do it in their own way. They realize they do it all in their own way. They want more comparability. And what we have found out, and what was a little bit more surprising, is that there are quite a few users that do not adjust the balance sheet for leases. These are, for example, quant analysts that use the Bloomberg data, that work with many data of many companies that don't go very much in depth, but that use general trends as provided by companies like Bloomberg. Or simply buy-side investors who do not have in-house analysts to do that kind of work. So we should never underestimate that where a lot of preparers tell us this is totally unnecessary because analysts already take this into account. It is simply not true. Not for everybody. Not everybody among the investor community agrees with our dual model, where we made a difference between, let's say, the equipment industry and leases on real estate. There's less enthusiasm for that, although even that part of the proposal does also find support among users. But we knew that this was a difficult issue. We're now going to start outreach with the preparer community. You can imagine that that will be a little bit more challenging, since many preparers are quite happy to keep leases off the balance sheet instead of on the balance sheet. Then insurance. We issued our exposure draft on insurance. I told you many times how important this was. I must say, the first publicity was quite supportive. The need for this standard is widely seen. We have been trying to get the message of urgency across, and that seems to be helping towards acceptance of this standard. What is also important is that, for example, the Financial Stability Board, of which the IASB is also a member, that they are in the process of identifying systematically important insurance companies. And they will find out that it is very hard to do because the numbers are not comparable around the world. So I think we'll also get a lot of support from the Financial Stability Board to get this work done. We have been quite upfront about the fact that in our second exposure draft, because this is a second exposure draft, that we've tried to deal with a lot of issues brought forward by the insurance company that had to do with accounting volatility. And we've tried to help them and try to make the model less volatile. But that had a trade-off, which is increased complexity. And we've been completely clear about that. This model addresses a lot of these issues, but the price to be paid is more complexity. And I think this will be one of the major themes of our outreach with users and preparers, is that the price you want to pay, or would you like us to take a step back and make the model perhaps a little bit more simple? And of course, there are lots of insurers that still think that the model gives too much volatility. I think the truth is that the insurance industry works in a very volatile climate, in a climate which is extremely challenging because of low interest rates, and we cannot pretend that that is not there. We can do our part to reduce artificial volatility, but where volatility is truly economic, we will simply have to show it. Then we published a feedback statement on the disclosure forum that we organized a couple of months ago in London, which I subsequently translated into a 10-point action plan, which I presented at the end of June in our IFRS conference in Amsterdam. What we are really trying to do around this issue of disclosures is to move the public debate from being focused simply at decreasing the volume of disclosures to a discussion on how to make disclosures more meaningful. probably also less voluminous, but the most important thing is that they should be more informative. In that speech in Amsterdam, I wanted to make clear that we as ISB are ready to take our responsibility through a whole series of both short-term and medium-term projects. The short-term actions are mainly centered on modifications of IES 1, and what we want to do is to make it clearer than currently is the case that immaterial disclosures should be actively eliminated from financial statements to avoid clutter. And we also want to make it clear that if information is not sufficiently material to make it to the face of the financial statements, that they should also not be included in the notes. And that's what a lot of preparers do if they think, well, just to be sure, let's just include it in the notes. We will also, and we have already started doing so, to make the disclosure language in our standards less prescriptive, and we want to also give more freedom in the presentation of accounting policies and notes. And these are all small changes which we can do relatively quickly. I am convinced that all these small changes taken together can really have a huge impact, and especially an impact on behavior. The disclosure overload problem is very much an issue of a behavioral issue. For very understandable reasons, preparers and auditors and regulators want to take the safe road and just want to include everything in the disclosures just to be sure that nothing is left out and that they cannot be blamed for things being left out. It creates a tick-in-the-box mentality, and that's what we would like to do away with. And I think these small changes will take away the excuses for boilerplate disclosures. I think our proposals have received good publicity, and we are now ready to engage with auditors, preparers, and regulators, because we cannot do this all by ourselves. End of last week, we closed our comment period on impairment. Obviously, we are still very busy digesting all the input that we have received. I'm sure we received it. Alan, do you have any idea how many letters we have received?
As of yesterday, 140.
140 letters. So I'm sure that the staff has worked all weekend to read the input. And our overall impression is that we have quite a positive feedback. And that after all the tries that we have had to make this work, we are now have a model that people think this can work. Please go ahead and finish the job. And that's what we're going to do. It's fair to say that users, investors are a little bit wary of the model. What they do like is that we have a difference between the good book and the bad book. They do recognize that. They are a bit wary of any kind of expected losses because they are afraid of earnings management, which is obviously the big danger of expected loss model, and which was the reason why we have the incurred loss model, the current incurred loss model to begin with. However, what we have found out through this process is also the incurred loss model is being applied rather differently around the world, and that it also has a lot of scope for earnings management. And a negative scope for earnings management in many countries, although the writing is on the wall and it is very clear that a lot of loan losses will have to be taken in the incurred loss model, banks find enough excuse to not do so. And it really depends also on the role of the regulators, whether banks do take their losses or do not take their losses. So there is also the incurred loss model also gives quite a bit of wide diversity in practice. It is a risk of an expected loss model, but I think overall it will be a huge improvement over what we have now. From the regulatory community, we have been in very intensive communication with the Basel Committee, for example. Traveled to Basel, I went myself, and they came to us. And we received some very good suggestions as to how to make the model even more forward-looking than it already is. We are afraid that in the way that we have currently developed the model, that banks will be looking again too much at lagging indicators like past due loans that are past due. We want to make abundantly clear that you also have to look at macroeconomic indicators, and that even when your delinquencies are still relatively low, if those economic indicators worsen significantly, that you have to start taking provisions. And I think that that's a change or adjustment or an improvement of the model that we can still do, and that will also have the advantage that it will move us a little bit closer to the United States, to the model of the FASB. Later this month, we will have a joint meeting with the FASB where we will compare notes. They will tell about their the feedback that they have received. We will talk about our feedback, and we will explore whether there are any openings for approachment of the two models. I think it will be a big challenge to get them completely converged because we are really in different places at this moment. But I think we should at least be ready, be able to move them a little bit closer together. Then finally, next week, I believe, or end of next week, we will publish a discussion paper on the conceptual framework. It is not a document that will end all the questions on accounting, if only because that is impossible. And we have really tried to discipline ourselves both in scope and in time. Nevertheless, it will be quite a hefty document of 283 pages, I believe. But even if we had taken 1,000 pages and 10 years, we would not have been able to answer all the questions. The main two main issues that we are going to address in this paper are two very sensitive issues that elicit a lot of fierce debate, namely measurement and OCI. On measurement, we are trying to formulate high-level guidance as to which measurement method to use in what circumstances. When do you apply fair value? When do you apply amortized cost? And secondly, we will try to provide more discipline about around other comprehensive income. Nobody really knows what it means. What is the significance of OCI? I think in our discussion paper we do a good effort to give legitimation for the choices or to put certain elements of income into OCI and give good reasons for that. And at the same time, we provide a couple of options as to provide more discipline and to prevent that in the future, everything that we find too difficult or too politically too difficult to deal with, that we just dump it in OCI. And so it's a little bit what has been happening every now and then. Although if you look back, I think most of the choices that have been made by both the FASB and the ISB have been quite reasonable. And I think this discussion paper, I hope you will find it readable. I think it is well written, and I hope it will give grounds for a very good discussion around the world. We have already had one very good discussion in ASEF, and we are going to have a second round of discussion with ASEF in September.
Thank you, Hans. Before I open the floor to discussion, I want to present apologies. I realized that I made a mistake when I mentioned the new nominations. I mentioned Pedro Mellon, probably because he couldn't be with us for family reasons, and obviously Pedro has completed his two terms, and I should have mentioned Doug Kuchung, who was reappointed. So I deeply apologize to both Doug Ku and Pedro, and to you all. Having said that, are there any comments or questions? Yes, Clemens.
Hans, on materiality, I welcome, you know, your approach to concentrate the disclosure really on material things and to exclude the non-material things. However, I want to mention that companies which are regulated by regulators, a lot of their disclosure, you know, is stipulated by the regulator. So it's not at our discretion, it's not at their discretion. that it would be very helpful also if the regulators could revisit their requirements as far as disclosure is concerned.
Yeah, I totally agree. This is true, and that is why I also mentioned that we do have to involve the regulators and the auditors, because auditors also have a very understandable tendency of wanting to play it safe. That's why we need to get both parties at around the table.
Well, on the same subject, just to underline what Clement said, my sense is that in some jurisdictions, disclosure is a response to concerns about litigation exposure. And regulators, I think, can do a great deal to shield companies from that exposure, so it's particularly important.
Yeah, I agree.
Aki?
The question regarding discussion paper or conceptual framework, do you have any timeline when the final paper, the standard, will be available?
We have said that our ambition is to finish the job in three years. 3 years, and up to now we have reached all our deadlines, although they were extremely tight. And it has shown me again, it is so helpful to have tight deadlines. If you don't have them, it's to the detriment of the quality of the work, usually, because you just take too much time and you don't force the issues. And now we have really worked very hard, and I think it has improved the quality of the work. Our constituent, our three-year plan was, it assumed that we would have had a comment period of how many days? 90 days, I think.
That
we assumed. And now, at the request of our constituents, we are going to 180, which seems reasonable, which will push back the deadline a little bit. But overall, I'm still quite comfortable that we can do it in three and a half years.
Thank you, Abdul.
Thank you. I just want to put on the record that quite a few institutions around the world waiting for IFRS guidance related to corporate insurance and Sukuk as very important and influential instruments. And I think in the future, I think these two issues has to be addressed because it's real needed. And it has so much influence in the financial statements. A lot of financial institutions. Thank you.
Point taken. Abdul, Scott.
Yes, thank you, Chairman. Just wanted to make a comment about disclosure and materiality and state something that I know you already know quite well. And that is that, of course, investors rely on disclosure for their work. They feel very strongly about this issue, and they tend, unlike preparers, to err on the side of wanting more disclosure rather than less. So I think it's very important to have extensive outreach with investors on this topic to understand what types of information they consider material for their work and what types of information they don't. They are, of course, the ultimate consumer of financial statements, and I think this issue in particular is very important for an outreach standpoint.
No, I agree, and that's why I also said the focus of this whole project should not be less disclosures for the sake of less disclosures, fewer disclosures for the sake of fewer disclosures. It should be better disclosures, and I think usually that will be a little bit less rather than more, but much more pointed. And I think that will be very helpful to the investor, and will, because it will force preparers to make their story much clearer.
Thank you, Winnie. Other questions or comments or remarks? I see none, so we will move to the next item. Thank you, Hans. The next item is a technical update on disclosures precisely by Alan Tishera.
there. Thank you. What I'll do is, Hans has already mentioned a little bit about the initiative for disclosure, and we've placed in front of you, and for people listening, they can get off our website, a copy of the disclosure feedback statement. So what I intend to do is just walk very quickly through, I guess, part of the journey of how we got to our 10-point plan, and go through just a couple of the details. This is not a technical debate, but I want to give you a flavour for the types of impediments that exist in current IFRS that we're trying to remove. And to Scott's point about making sure investors are part of the story, you'll see that as well as actually trying to clarify some issues, we are going to suggest as part of our 10-point plan adding some disclosure requirements, because we think that helps with the clarity and connectivity within the financial statements. So I'll walk through. So this is Agenda Paper 2A, and as I said, you've got the feedback statement as well. The catalyst for this, starting on the first slide, was the agenda consultation, and people said we need a disclosure framework. And I think, to put a sense in it, most people, when we develop our individual standards, are reasonably comfortable with the disclosures that go with those standards. What they're worried about is when you sit there and you look at the cumulative effect of all of those individual standards, and the ability of entities or the incentives for entities to try and identify within those standards what the most important aspects of the business are and how to communicate. So people asked us in our agenda consultation to explore this far more than we were doing, and to develop a proper disclosure framework. Now, we initially suggested that should be done at the framework level. And we still intend to have some very high-level disclosure principles within the framework. But two things came out of that. One is we don't want to oversell or create an expectation that we're going to create a full disclosure framework within the conceptual framework. That's not the place. We think that's better done at the standards level. And the second thing is that as fast as we're going, you know, Hans has said it's a very aggressive timetable. We're talking about the end of 2015 before we get the framework completed. We then started on a journey to look at disclosure. We'd be looking at 2020 or thereabouts before we make some significant improvements. And so we asked whether or not it was possible to, within the context of existing IFRSs, make some changes that will actually be the catalyst for improving financial reporting disclosures more generally, without us having to wait until the framework's finished. So so in the light of that, we did two things. Just before Christmas last year, we put in place a survey. It wasn't designed to be a comprehensive survey, but we're quite pleased we got 225 responses without much effort. It shows how passionate people are about this, both from preparers and users and others. And without going into too much detail, there were almost two views, and this is, I think, on slide 5. There's a little Venn diagram. The users said it's about poor communication and, to Scott's point, not enough relevant information. The repairers said it's all about overload. But there were common themes. One was there's too much generic language in there. When we talk about accounting policies, that will come to light. And the other is there's too much immaterial information. In other words, it's hard to see what's important for an organisation because there's just so much information being presented. I won't say conveyed, but actually printed or presented in financial reports. So common themes, in a sense. We held a disclosure forum or discussion forum at the end of January. We had 120 people from mostly from Europe and UK, a few from outside, but clearly when you're based in London, you're going to that'll be the bias will be towards people who can get access. But we did webcast it, and we had people sitting through the night listening to the webcast for the whole time, and we gave them the chance to ask questions as well via the webcast. We started off, one of the important things is, this is not new. People have been thinking about this for a long time. The FASB is doing work, EFRAG's been doing work, the European Standards Setters, the UK Board's been doing work by itself, Scottish and New Zealand Institutes did some work. Lots of people are thinking about disclosure. I think it's important is that people look to us. We're the only global organisation who can bring all this together. And so they're asking us to step up and actually do something at a global level rather than having a series of developments going on around the globe. So at the forum, I think with just to summarise it very quickly in a sense, I think we got quite a consistent message there. We had a user, an analyst presenting to us. We had a preparer, Russell Pico from HSBC. Paul Lee was the analyst. And they had a very common message, and that is preparers are actually wanting to communicate and tell a story and present their business as they think it ought to be presented. And investors want to hear that story, they want to listen to it. And they see that there are some impediments to that. Hans has already touched on a few, and Clemens, about some of the problems that are that you have to put this in there because there's a litigation risk that's going on, and it's easier to disclose. Russell described it as being the price of failure is very high. I think Hans, in your speech in Amsterdam, said nobody's ever been sued for disclosing something. It's usually the other way around if you miss something out. So the incentives are such that it always seems to be that there's lots and lots of information in there. And people said it was very difficult to look at a set of financial statements and to get a clear picture of what was going on sometimes for an organisation. There are some very specific issues came up, though, about materiality and about some of the constraints that we have. One of the very simple examples I like to give is that there are two companies that were given as examples of good financial reporting that had kind of broken the mould. One had basically, if you look through their financial statements, you'd see it was put out in sections where the accounting policy, the income and the balance sheet items were all presented together around that particular topic. In other words, they didn't have what we would typically see with financial statements of the main primary financial statements followed by accounting policies followed by notes. So they had actually structured it in a way that they thought was the clearest communication. That's the type of thing that people say they'd like to do. But Russell Pico made a very simple comment. He said, I don't think IS1 allows us to do that, one of our standards, and I'll get to why there's a barrier there. So it seems like that people told us that some of the way we express our standards and we talk about materiality is actually getting in the way of communication between preparers and investors. So we took that on board, and what we decided is a plan that Hans set out in a speech in Amsterdam. Essentially, there are some short-term initiatives and then some longer-term initiatives. So the short-term initiatives are, in terms of two specific items. One is having a look at our current standard IS1, which basically sets out the structure for financial statements, talks about accounting policies and so on. And I'll give you two little issues, and these are illustrative of the types of things we're addressing. One is on the presentation order. One of the paragraphs, and I could quote the number, but I've forgotten the number now, I think it's 23, something like that, says that the normal order of presentation of the notes to the financial statements is as follows, colon, and then it goes, the accounting policies, and then the next line it says, the supplementary notes or explanatory notes presented in the same order as the items in the balance sheet and income statement. And that means that you've got a bank, for example, that's going to have its financial instruments and then perhaps its property, plant and equipment. And a chemical company, it's going to have financial instruments and property, plant and equipment, where in fact it could be the importance is actually switched. And so people are looking at that and saying, if it's normal that that's the way it needs to be presented, I'm prevented from presenting it in any other way. And so we're going to look at amending that and taking away that what we see as being an inhibitor to people having a bit more flexibility about presenting. Now, it is it's a difficult issue, and we're going to have to see what feedback we get, because some of the feedback that we heard through Europe in particular is they like that standard order because it's easier to find things. They always know that, you know, note number 6 is property, plant and equipment, for example. But we think the overwhelming message was it's an inhibitor to good communication. One of the other issues is accounting policies. Within IS1, it says that you should present significant accounting policies. And so most people looking at that would think that those are the policies that are important to an entity. But if you look through now, most businesses would have 6 or 7 pages of accounting policies. One of the presenters at the forum told us they could tell who the auditors were of particular companies because the auditors have model financial statements, and these companies would copy those accounting policy descriptions into there. They do an excellent job, basically, of summarising our requirements in the IFRSs. In other words, they were very generic, and you couldn't tell in the 6 pages which ones were important or not. Again, we talked about how we can break that mould, and one of the possibilities is to talk about identifying the most significant policies up front in it, or in relation to, you could present them with the other explanatory notes. And any other, I'll call them boilerplate policies or generic policies, you might relegate to the back of the financial statements, and being able to, in a sense, give people permission to do that. And the type of thing with IAS 1, again, going back to down to a technical level, there's a sentence in there that says you should only present significant policies. And then it says, it goes on to say, for example, if a company pays taxation, we expect to see the policy for tax. There is no discretion about what your accounting policy is for tax. It's a very generic approach in IAS 12. And so anybody reading that would say, well, if I pay tax and I have to put my policy, I've got revenue, I've got to put a policy, there must be a policy for everything in there. So we see that as being, again, encouraging generic presentation of policies and not getting down to the core of what's really important to me. Those are the types of changes we're going to make. One of the other sort of related short term, Hans mentioned drafting. The two types of examples we have where people feel uncomfortable is we do have a statement in IS 1 that says you don't have to disclose something if it's not material. It's a very generic statement. Then they'll go and read an accounting standard that says it'll provide a nice clear objective for what the standard's trying to achieve. And then we'll say, to meet that objective, an entity shall disclose the following, and then we'll list them. And people tell us it's very hard to argue that quite a generic statement that you don't have to disclose something material can override a standard where it says an entity shall disclose. And in particular, we have one standard, and I think it's IFRS 2, where it says an entity shall disclose at a minimum, colon, and then lists. It's very hard to argue that, again, a generic materiality override can override something as specific as that. We have to be careful because when we developed IFRS 2, which is about share-based payments and any standard, we developed those disclosure requirements hand-in-hand with how we thought about recognition and measurement. So we don't just want to do, as some have suggested, just cross out, you have to disclose those things. We have to think about this carefully. But we certainly want to make sure that we don't create disclosure requirements that imply a checklist approach. So for new standards, we've actually started to modify the wording a little bit to talk about the types of information an entity should consider disclosing to meet the objective. And so it's slightly less prescriptive, and we're going to see if that changes behaviour a bit. So in the short term, there are some little fixes there. It's not just about taking things away. In one case, we're going to suggest there's a thing that investors have been asked for a net debt reconciliation for quite a long time. So we're going to take a proposal to the board to potentially add that as a requirement as well. And that's a case where people are looking at financial statements to see bits and pieces and can't connect those pieces together. And a net debt reconciliation is one that actually provides connectivity between those. Again, it's a direct response to investor a call from investors that came through the agenda consultation loud and clear. The other shorter-term one is on materiality, and we have to be very careful about the way we proceed with that because materiality, some comments have come back already, it's used by regulators and others. People have a different sense of materiality. We will work with the auditing community and the regulators to see the extent to which we should develop education material or whether that's something that they should develop education material. But we know that materiality is very critical to this. So our short-term changes are not about changing what materiality is. We're hoping that we're going to give a little more freedom to people to be able to tell a story, but it's going to take a medium term before we actually look at any potential changes to how we express materiality. Now, in the longer term, we've talked about disclosure framework. Some trustees will recall we had a financial statement presentation project that we put on hold in about 2010, I think. We were very close to an exposure draft at that stage. A lot of good thinking went on in there, but we're going to basically look to see whether or not we should take our core presentation standards. I'll quote the numbers IS 1, 7 and 8, but they're essentially what your income statement looks like, your balance sheet and your cash flow statement, and then accounting policies and comparability and things like that, whether we should replace those with one generic standard that really looks at disclosure generally, and that would essentially be a disclosure framework. we could wait until we finish our conceptual framework work, but we think we should start there now. And essentially that will move on to our research agenda, so we start to do a lot of the thinking, so we're ready to go once we finish the framework. And in a way, that's a chance for us to step back and review all of the standards together as well, and see whether there's some way that we can make it more helpful to people to look at the whole picture rather than just focusing on standard-by-standard disclosures. So there's a lot of work to do, but we're starting the short-term things. We are, for example, in September taking our first papers to the board to look at changes to our IS1. So you'll see quite quick action in there. And that's direct response to the feedback we had, both agenda consultation and disclosure forum. So I'm not sure if there are any questions or about that.
Thank you, Alan, for this comprehensive presentation. I see Harvey and Heidi.
Alan, that was an excellent presentation, and this is an immensely important set of projects on disclosure. Just a note of caution, since I've spent a meaningful part of my professional life dealing with disclosure and materiality, it is very difficult. If you fly at 30,000 or 40,000 feet, it's easy for preparers to worry about overload, want bright lines, want certainty, and one understands that. It's just as important for regulators and investors to worry about not losing really important information. It's you and Hans have been saying. But don't think for a minute this will be easy water, as I think you understand. Now, in the U.S., lawyers think of this as their special area. I did a piece at the SEC when I was general counsel called Staff Accounting Bulletin 99, where I tried to tell the world everything I knew about materiality in about 110 pages, and I'm not sure it finished the debate. This, as I say, is the project I fully support, but there has to be a note of caution and concern, and if ever due process is important, it's in this area, to keep reaching out and getting responses and getting thoughts, both from investors and the regulatory community.
Thank you, Harvey. Any comments on that? No? Heidi?
I think also, Harvey, this is a really important topic. I can't tell you how many times, sitting around audit committees, we talk about materiality in the context of what it means for the company. And with oftentimes preparers saying, well, it's not material now, we'll worry about it next quarter. And I think it's just that sort of passage of time issue that's the hardest to grapple with. At what point do you determine you should give that concern out there to your investor? I'm also a little concerned about one meeting in one area of the world, and even though you had outreach and a webcast, I think somebody staying up in the middle of the night to listen and participate perhaps might be supplemented by meetings elsewhere in the world with different sets of companies, etc. So I do think that geography informs concepts of materiality as well, and you might be advised to think about that.
Thank you. Alan, you want to comment?
No. These comments are both welcome and not unexpected, because there are Supreme Court judgments on materiality, and so we're quite aware that it's an area to tread quite carefully in. One of the things we did talk about, we are going to make sure we're involving the international community, both auditing and securities regulators as well. So, and we started steps in that direction.
Aki?
The one question I have is you are going to attack the materiality. Definition is very important. But are you going to cover qualitative nature of materiality or quantitative nature of materiality? That is my first question. Then, materiality judgment depends on the preparer corporation as well as auditors. How do you determine which area is auditor judgment or company judgment, which area is accounting standard setter judgment?
First of all, I don't want to answer that question directly because I think the first phase of our materiality issue is to find out the nature of the problem and why we're getting potentially different judgments. But I will go a little bit further than that in terms of my personal view is it's mainly qualitative things and that you're looking at. We already have, for example, I would consider it to be application guidance on materiality in relation to related party transactions. In other words, we explain in one of our standards that if you're dealing with parties that are related to you in some way, that maybe that's something that is more important to investors or the people reading it, because there could be some influences because of that relationship. So in a sense, that's putting an overlay on materiality. You know, I sort of tongue-in-cheek say, you know, bribes. If you're paying bribes to somebody, it's not a quantitative assessment. I think that's probably a pretty strong qualitative assessment. But the last thing we want to do is to start to develop a whole series of mechanical, this is what materiality means. We need to understand the problem much more carefully before we start to take that journey.
Yes, Ian.
Oh, sure.
I take Aki's point, and I often think in terms of disclosures, a much better word is relevance, because I think materiality gets caught up in a whole lot of history and in other areas of judgment as well. And it just seems to me what we want really is relevant disclosure, you know, and that involves materiality, but it's sort of a more of a qualitative judgment as well.
Other comments? Well, thank you, Alan. We then move to the next and last item on the agenda, which is the report of the chair of the due process oversight committee, Scott Evans. You have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. The due process committee met for 2 hours yesterday morning and on a number of topics. I'll review them briefly. First off, we received a progress report on due process aspects of the ISB technical agenda from Alan Teixeira, including a focus on classification and measurement, impairment, hedge accounting, and the conceptual framework. The committee was satisfied that these projects are proceeding with the transparency and inclusion that are required and specified by the due process handbook. Secondly, we moved on to a life cycle review of the revenue recognition project, and we did this in order to permit the ISB to proceed with the final balloting of this standard. This project dates back to 2002 and includes a discussion paper in 2008, two exposure drafts in 2010 and 2011, 300 outreach meetings, numerous papers, and 4 planned transition workshops. Now, given the central importance of revenue recognition to the production of financial statements by all companies in all sectors, the ISB went to extraordinary lengths to ensure that all constituents had an opportunity to participate in this process. The committee was therefore quite satisfied that the project had completed the due process steps necessary to move to final balloting. Next, we conducted our annual review of consultative groups. At present, all groups are reported to be operating effectively, and several new groups are in the formation stage. The committee inquired about the effectiveness of several project working groups that actually didn't hold any formal meetings in the past year. We thought this required some explanation, particularly because of the importance of the projects in question, which included financial instruments, leases, and insurance, some of the most important projects that the board is working on. We were satisfied with the explanation that most of the project working groups have the bulk of their meetings at the beginning of the project's life as the initial exposure draft is being contemplated. As the project advances towards its final stages, the role of the working group evolves so that it becomes an advisory group that doesn't have as much need to meet, and yet the ISB needs to keep these groups active in order for the individuals in these projects to be active participants in the process. Many times in one-on-one discussions with the board members and staff members for clarification and advice. The remainder of our meeting was spent reviewing the production timing of documents for the remainder of the year because there's so many activities that are going on. The ISB is being very careful not to overload constituencies with too much at the same time. Reviewing the reporting protocol and examining the updated format for the DPOC web pages, which we all thought was a great improvement and makes it much easier for all users of the website to understand the workings of the DPOC. Finally, the DPOC received no complaints between our last meeting in April and our meeting yesterday morning. However, I should note that we did receive a complaint letter from Business Europe several hours after our meeting last night, so we didn't have time to look at it at this meeting. But we take this very seriously. We'll examine this complaint and address it promptly at the next meeting in accordance with the procedures outlined in the due process handbook. I'd invite any committee members to amplify on topics that I may have neglected to give emphasis to or any corrections. Hearing none, I'd like to thank particularly Alan Teixeira, David Loeth, and the staff for another outstanding meeting. There's a tremendous amount of preparation that goes into these meetings. There's an extensive amount of due process that's being conducted. Speaking for the committee, it's quite impressive, and we're very pleased with the progress to date.
Thank you, Scott. If I remind well, I think my first meeting, you had a number of letters. And since a few meetings, we see nearly no letters at all. So I suppose that the due process committee is working so well that everybody is happy.
And in some ways it's satisfying to get one letter now to work on, so we have a reason for our existence.
What's the letter about, Scott?
The letter had to do, and I only reviewed it briefly, but it had to do with the way that a previous letter from Business Europe on one of their comment letters was characterized by the staff as it was passed on to the ISB, and whether or not the staff had characterized it correctly or not. All complaint letters we take seriously, but we will immediately go to research. They named a number of different communications. We'll post the letter to our website. This will all happen transparently, and we'll have a response to them that we'll also post on the website.
Thank you very much. This completes the agenda. Is there any other business? Yes, wise man.
I just want to say that, on behalf of South Africa, myself and Derek, that we really appreciated and enjoyed hosting you. We are exceptionally pleased that the two public events, the stakeholder session on Tuesday morning and also last night, went very well. I'm sure you experienced yourself the excitement of the people at just having the opportunity to share insights about new developments, in standard setting, with yourselves, talk directly to the chairman of the Everest Foundation, the chairman of the ASB, and all the trustees. It was really very special, and it's something that I'm sure that our people who are very involved in accounting and regulatory, activities. We'll talk about this visit for quite some time to come. And we are also pleased that it was possible for the chief executive of the Pan-African Federation of Accountants to join us and to experience it firsthand what really
how the foundation works, how the ISP works, and we have the opportunity to sit next to the chairman of ISP. And it was great to hear Hans making the commitment that he's going to be coming to Africa next year. So we're going to hold him to that. And we also look forward to working closely now with the foundation and the ISP in just accelerating adoption of IFRS in other African countries. I'm sure I'm not just talking for myself. I'm talking on behalf of SAICA and other colleagues, that we'll do everything that we can to actually work with you to really make sure that we accelerate adoption in other African countries. So thank you very much. I hope all of you will travel safely to your destinations. It has really been a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Well, thank you, wise man, for these very nice comments, but I think it is up to us to thank you and to thank your colleagues for your very warm welcome, for the role South Africa plays in that field. As I said yesterday, it was well-founded that our first visit to Africa was in South Africa, because you've been so committed and so early committed, and we know how you participate very effectively to the work of the organization. And we foresee further cooperation and development in Africa. As you mentioned, Hans will visit them, and I hope that we will have other opportunities to visit Africa in the near future. So on behalf of my fellow trustees, warm thanks for your hospitality and congratulations for what has been achieved here. Having said that, I would like to thank you all and to thank the staff for the organization of this meeting that went extremely well, as usual, I would say. So I would really thank you for the excellent organization. Yael, you wanted to say something.
I just wanted to say, she's not here, but Jenny Kale organized this meeting. It was her first meeting, and she did an extraordinary job, I think. So if you could thank her. She's not here, but...
You'll transmit the applause.
Yes.
Well, safely back home to all of you, and the next meeting will be held in Frankfurt on the 17th of October. Thanks all. Stand at the end of the day. Stand at the end of the day. Yeah.